Gary Ward was the head baseball coach at Oklahoma State University from 1978 to 1996. Ward won 17 Big 8 Conference championships at OSU, including 16 in a row from 1980 to 1996. He led his team to 18 40-win seasons, and 12 times he finished in the top 10. Coach Ward later became the head baseball coach at New Mexico State University. During his tenure, he became only the 24th coach in college baseball history to gain 1,000 career wins. This interview was recorded by sports historian Wayne McCombs, May 4, 1999, for Voices of Sports Legends, and is heard on the Oral History website, voicesofoklahoma.com.
Coach Ward, you're from the Bartlesville area, Ramona?
Yes, from the small farm community out there and kind of a self-sufficient operation back in the 40s and Depression times, you know, and it was probably a very formative years. When you go through those kind of things, you probably end up being kind of conservative, and you understand work ethic, and you certainly understand family and responsibility, and I think that's something you maybe looked on at the time as a hardship, but as you mature, you look back on it as a very important stage of life where you understood some, you begin to understand some very important values that carried over into the coaching career.
Well, I heard you were a cowboy for a while, wrestling cattle, is that true?
Well, you know, those days, coming out of World War II, I was born in 40, and there weren't many apparatus-type farm machinery available. It all had been taken up with the mechanization of the country toward war, and so I was, my first memories were of teams of horses and bundle wagons and stationary thrashers and mostly just a lot of work from that standpoint. Yeah. And you know, the tractor and electricity and indoor plumbing and all those things came rather later in life. So it was a unique period to live through. And again, it has a lot to do with the set of your sail.
Now, you're had some time to play sports. There was a town team. What was it? Sponsored by Wayne's Garage. Is that right? And you guys played all over the area.
Yeah, you know, baseball was big in Ramona. They had one of the first fields that was lit. I think it was about 51. And when the REA came, the Rural Electric Cooperatives came into being, and people in the community had enough foresight to say, we want to do something like this. And so we started youth baseball there, and they hosted large tournaments in the summer, and the entire community was involved. It was previously a community that embraced what we call town teams in those days. And I think as a farm kid, you see the sports venues as excitement and an escape from hauling hay and wrestling steers. So you're kind of pulled toward that because it got you out of work. That's probably the main motivation. Yeah.
Well, now, you were a high school sports star, played basketball at Ramona, and now you went to Phillips, is that correct, when you first played for Joe Record?
Yes, he was really an important guy. We were very strong Baptist, a very strong Christian home. Phillips was an academic environment, private school, Christian atmosphere, all those things were valued at the time, and I had an opportunity to play both basketball and baseball. One of the advantages of a small school is you play everything that's played, whether it's track or volleyball or whatever the case may be, and you do it year-round. And maybe it's a disadvantage in the fact you don't specialize in a sport, but I went into college undecided on whether basketball or baseball was the ticket. And basketball in those days provided more scholarship opportunity, and this was an ideal situation, I thought, at the time. I really have great respect today for Joe Record. He was a very committed person, very passionate about his sport. He was a very professional teacher at the university. I had great success with him and had the opportunity to play as a freshman, but the basketball side of it didn't work out real well, and was not pleased with what was happening there, and really felt like maybe I had more ability on that side of the of the sport. And certainly it was a sport in which to get a college education from my background, it probably was going to have to be the scholarship sport. So I made a real tough decision for a young man at the time to transfer out to seek a better basketball opportunity, and I ended up at Northeastern A&M at Miami and played for Max Buzzard, another extraordinary gentleman.
Wright was also at Pawhuska as a basketball coach.
Yeah, Max was just, he's a very special guy. And Homer Thomas ran the baseball program, and Northeastern at the time had, along with Cameron, probably had the two great junior college athletic programs in the country. It was read, here we were led by a guy named Bruce Carter, the president. He was very involved with a student athlete. And it really turned us up. Jack Hartman was coaching at Coffeyville at the time. We played four great games against them, and the exposure that we got both in basketball to the regional finals and to baseball, which we went to Grand Junction to the national championships, opened my athletic career up, and it also kind of broadened our horizons from the standpoint of being a kind of an Okie farm boy. It made you realize there was a big world out there, and so I actively pursued scholarship opportunities away from the area. Eventually had signed with Gordon Morgan, outstanding coach we know of today, but he was at that time a young coach at Tulsa University, and he convinced me to come there and play baseball. About, I was working in a pipeline for Shell Oil Company over in the Osage, and I got a call in August from a guy named Presley Askew, who was coaching at New Mexico State. He made me a point guard, and I really went there because they were in the Border Conference, and they played Arizona State and Arizona in baseball, and that was the place to go play, and they were integrated, which was rare in those days, and I had aspirations to play in the NBA, and all those dreams that a young man have were kind of come together. And so it was August before I made a decision to go to Oklahoma State. I jumped in my 51 Ford, and I was married, and put my $15 television in the back seat.
What year did you go to New Mexico?
I went out there in 1960.
Yes.
And spent 2 years as a player and 1 year as a graduate assistant coaching the freshman team, and then returned there during the 60s to get my master's degree. So my son is now the head coach at New Mexico State Baseball in his third year. That's Rocky, who played for me at Oklahoma State.
Yes.
So we still have great contacts in the Southwest.
Now, you actually came back to Northeast Oklahoma. You were a coach and teacher at Collinsville. Is that right?
Yes.
What year was that?
That was 63. I came back in fall of 63, coached football, basketball, and baseball, spent 6 years there, and in the summers went back to southern New Mexico to work on my master's degree. And, again, I've been very fortunate. There's a gentleman, the superintendent of schools was Hal Wilson. He was just a dynamic person and a mentor, as was Record and Buzzard and Askew, and the goodness of those people and the quality of their humanness and the way they dealt with the disciplines of their life were great influences, and they really serve as a catalyst for people. I think it made me aware of our responsibility of leadership in the role of coach-teacher. And I left there in 69, took a job at Yavapai Community College, which was a new college. I'd interviewed for two or three college jobs.
Now, this is in Arizona, right?
This is in Arizona, in Prescott, Arizona.
Okay.
It's about 90 miles north of Phoenix, very beautiful mountain area. And
what year did you go there?
That was 69,
mm-hmm.
And it was a new college, and we were a part of the founding faculty. In that period of time, the athletic director there was a guy named Dave Brown, who David and I had started together for 2 years in New Mexico State, and obviously traveling through the West playing basketball. He was an Albuquerque guy, and we just kind of hooked up, and it was really a great marriage, two guys who felt like they could go do anything at age of 29 and 30 years old, and we built nationally competitive programs, eventually won national titles in 75 and 77 in baseball that really served as a catapult career-wise. I also got involved with summer camps, and we ran camps for the Phoenix Suns and got to know most of their key personnel, the Van Arsdales, the Jerry Colangelo, who's still now the general manager, and Cotton Fitzsimmons, who was a legendary coach with the Suns. Got to know John McLeod. We had the Suns, in fact, come up and do their preseason work in Prescott for a couple of weeks, and it was a really great experience. It was a small community, but it got your name out, and you got contacted in the professional levels. And oddly enough, at that time, I made a decision to get out of basketball. It's probably a story not known by too many people, but in the 73-74 period, doing both those and teaching a heavy load had really gotten to the point where it was almost too much. And I interviewed with Eddie Sutton when Eddie took the Arkansas job, and he was very specific that he wanted Gene Cady if he could get him. He didn't know if he'd get him if Gene didn't want to leave Hutchison Junior College at the time. And Gene's now the head coach at Purdue, as most people know.
Yes, that
I would probably be the guy. And so a week or so later, Gene decided to go to Arkansas with Coach Sutton. And about 3 weeks later, Jerry Hale came in from Southern Idaho and took the Oral Roberts job and called. And I came in and interviewed for that job. And it was a pretty good fit, but there were some things needed there that we discussed, and I thought he might need to move in another direction, and he did. And so when I went back to Prescott, I kind of walked the mountains and made a decision. I've got to get in one sport or the other and really, for the first time, be a specialist in a sport and go where I need to go professionally. And that led to baseball being the answer, and we won a national title in 75 and again in 77. So, again, a transition period, one of those fortunate times where you made some decent decisions, and it puts you on the path that you eventually follow.
Well, how did you get in when the baseball job opened up at Oklahoma State in 77, how did you get in contact with that opening, and how did you secure the job?
Now, oddly enough, a name known to most Tulsans, Gene Shell, was the coach at the University of Tulsa, trusted me in recruiting a number of Arizona players. He had one of my players, Dan Pettijohn, and that's followed by Eddie Rivera, an outstanding pitcher, and another player or two out of the league, Mitch Chilton, came back and played and played well for him. And so he went through a period of time where he gained great trust, and we had conversations frequently. He said, by the way, the Oklahoma State job looks like it may open, and they have talked to me, but I'm pretty satisfied where I am, and you could probably get that job. And so he introduced me to a couple of people in Tulsa. And about a year and a half later, as the job unfolded, we had developed some rapport, and they had some feelings for Jim Killingsworth, had a contact. And, you know, these things are all sometimes political or by fate, I'm not sure. But when the job opened, Jim was the basketball coach and Floyd Gass the athletic director, and we had four or five people to call, and they had enough influence to put our name under consideration. And at the same time, we were at a point where we had just won a national title, had been ranked number one in the country throughout 76, and were on the road to another national championship. And so it was a dream job for me, being able to return home to my roots. And I took a pretty good financial cut from the West to come back and take the job, and did so with relish.
Well, after you are named the head baseball coach at Oklahoma State, in 1977, Oklahoma State goes 16-28. And then your first year, you go 40-22. Now, was this the reason for your success? Was the players there, or some of the players you brought in, like Rick Kranitz, Dave Edwards, and Randy Evans?
Yeah, we brought with us eight of the players off of our national championship ball club, plus two others out of the league, and then at midterm that year brought a couple of more in. Probably the hardest thing I ever did in coaching is I had to go through the 16 or 17 returning players from Oklahoma State and check with pro scouts and people to see who might be usable. But you make a transition of that nature in baseball rarely, and it's hard because you're punishing guys that somebody else has brought there. It's not the player's fault that he doesn't fit. And so I went through individual calls to a lot of parents, and I only kept four players from the returning ball club, and we had the okay to negate scholarship offers of the past, and it was a very difficult time, but we felt like to make any kind of transition, both in attitude and in talent level, we had to make those kind of decisions, so we chose to do that. And they immediately responded and surprisingly won a Big 8 title in the first year. And it gave us a couple of years where we needed to establish ourselves nationally as a recruiting base and to rebuild facilities and get plans underway. And so people forget that from that 77 season, or 78 season in effect, we spent 79 struggling with an average club. We had good numbers, but we weren't playing a particularly difficult schedule. And 80, we turned it around as we had a great year, but failed in the Big 8 tournament, losing 2 one-run games. And I believe the numbers going into the tournament that year were like 43-8 or something, and lost 2 to Nebraska and Missouri and did not get an NCAA bid. So we're sitting there after 3 years feeling like we've done things right, and we have a stadium planned, and it's coming. The breakthrough year, Wayne, was in 81. It was a really important year for us.
Well, in 1980, you're 43-10, have good numbers, and like you say, you're nipped in the Big Eight tournament those years. But then in 81, a lot of things happen, such as the building of Allie Reynolds Stadium. What was your part in raising awareness for the stadium and the money for Allie Reynolds Stadium? I mean, it was built and opened in 81 and is still a wonderful facility today. What was your background in raising the awareness and the need and the money for a new baseball park at Oklahoma State?
When I came there, the greatest strength that I found immediately was the quality of the people. There was a very outstanding passion and a love, and they had had traditionally great success, and Henry Iba's influence on the non-revenue-producing sports, the non-basketball football people, had had more to do with the success of wrestling, track, and all the successes of golf, tennis, baseball, et cetera, at Oklahoma State. He was a visionary who saw the need for a well-rounded program. Maybe it was in opposition to the great success that Oklahoma and Bud Wilkinson began to have in those years as well. I'm not sure how it evolved, but when I arrived there, we went anywhere that we could go with the high school and college relations, with the alumni group, with the booster situation to meet people and to share our dream and our vision with them.
How did it make you feel when they had the dedication ceremonies and people like Warren Spahn and Bill Dickey and Mickey Mantle were there for the dedication?
Well, one of the great keys was convincing Allie to let us put his name on the stadium. His wife, Arlene, was very influential in that because Allie was such a humble man. He made a contribution, but more important was that he put his stamp of approval on it, and he had great influence in bringing those great names in there, and that was an extraordinary day. I kind of look back on it, and I was so busy involved with the ball club and the weekend and the opening of the stadium that I didn't get Mickey's autograph. I didn't get Whitey Ford's autograph. I was just running 100 miles an hour in a number of different directions. But it was a glorious happening that said we have arrived, and not only have we arrived, but we have a groundswell of support statewide. These people now have something to be proud of. We know the program is in good shape. Our job now is to find a way to win and get at the national level, and obviously it served as the catalyst for almost everything that happened for the next decade or so.
Well, you have a wonderful record there. You win 85% of your games in Allie Reynolds Stadium. You win 430 and only lose 74 in your years there. So just a marvelous facility and a tremendous way to show off the Oklahoma State program. Let's go back just a little bit to 1978. Where you win your first Big Eight tournament. You win 17 of the 19 Big Eight tournaments played. You win 16 in a row. What was that like when Big Eight tournament time came around? Did you tell your players this is where we need to be, or was there a confidence among the players? Was there a tradition, you know, like the old Yankees or something? World Series time. It's now time for us to win. What did you do to your players to get them motivated to just dominate the Big Eight tournament?
Well, I think it was that important. I think numbers, wins and losses in those days wasn't the critical issue, and we proved that in 80 at 43-8 and lost twice and didn't get a bid. There were only 32 teams who qualified. We knew coming out of Yavapai that the regular season's okay, but regardless of seeding, you're going to have to win a state tournament, a regional tournament. And for you to get what you want and to meet your goals personally, professionally, and what you're trying to sell in your community, you've got to play at the national level. We added lights later to Reynolds Stadium with a $200,000 gift. That was a part of that kind of building. And you're saying, we're going to play at the national championship level. And a lot of people look at you like this young man is out of his gourd. But you go sell with passion and with a dream, and these things begin to evolve. It's a synergistic type of energy that begins to be created. But eventually, you've got to win at a higher level. And we realized, and our players and our program realized, that 43-10 is not good enough, that whatever we do, we'll schedule tougher, we'll play the best to become the best, we'll get lights on this facility. We're not only going to play in regionals, but we're going to host regionals, which we saw at the time as one of the real keys in getting to Omaha. And so, yes, the emphasis on the tournament was such that we knew not only were you qualified by winning the Big Eight tournament, but that you also would establish seeding on a national basis, and you would also, more importantly than all, if you can win Big A tournaments, your chances of hosting regionals would be enhanced a great deal. And so our background told us this, and everything about what we're trying to do told us this, and we believed in that manner. And we treated the Big A tournament as a brand new season, that everything we did prior to that was in preparation for that moment, for those 4 or 5 days, and then had to replicate that in the following week in a regional, hopefully at home at Reynolds, which we did host it from 82 to 87 or 86 for 5 years in a row, all winners, all Omaha trips. So the dream came to fruition, and it came to it from the standpoint that we had to be a tournament ball club prepared to play the last month of the season if we were going to reach our personal and team goals.
Well, of course, the goal of any college baseball team is to be in the College World Series, and you were just had an amazing string of 7 consecutive years of reaching the College World Series from 1981 to 1987. Tell me about those teams back in those days. You had stars galore. Tell me about your goal of each year reaching the College World Series and what that meant to you and your program those 7 straight years.
Well, first of all, my experience as a junior college person having won 2 national titles indicated that the difference is just so often attitude and an atmosphere that you create, an atmosphere of expectation. And we created that at Oklahoma State. And I thought when we broke through and beat a Oral Roberts club in 1981 in Tulsa to win the regional, we go to a College World Series and beat South Carolina and Arizona State and Miami, Florida, losing eventually the national championship game to Arizona State. And it was truly a Cinderella ball club. But on the bus returning back, it allowed us to sit with our staff and say, gentlemen, we have broken through and we're going to go back repeatedly. Tradition is going to be the driving force. I rearranged my staff, gave recruiting coordination to Tom Holliday, gave more of the day-to-day operations to some assistance coaches, Dave Holliday. Both those young men had played for me at Yavapai. Both were out of Uniontown, Pennsylvania. And we reorganized on the 8-hour bus ride back from Omaha, and I said, I'm going to go raise more money. We're going to raise season tickets. We're going to sell outfield fence signs. We're going to enhance our radio broadcast system. We're going to build an infrastructure around us now based on this one great Cinderella season that will carry us for decades to come. And I know in the conversations with Tom later, he said, you know, Coach, I thought you were absolutely crazy. Nobody in the Midwest has ever had that kind of record. If you were at Miami, Florida, that might be expected. And we've laughed about it many times since then. But this decade of the 80s and the first hosting of a regional in 82, all those goals begin to be reached, and people around you begin to really believe, and the bandwagons couldn't be built fast enough, and people came to us in droves, mm-hmm. and the stadium's completed, and you're selling 1,000 season tickets, and revenue is $250,000 a year, and all the things thought improbable and impossible came to pass. With that, recruiting became much more simplistic, where you had to sell your soul and work continuously to sell a youngster to come to Stillwater. All of a sudden, television brought the nation's consciousness to us. And so the contacts that you make to recruit a Traber out of Maryland or an Incavilla out of Pebble Beach, California, it made us national in scope, and we were willing to embrace that and did so. And in 82, 83, 84, the recruiting was put us in a top 5 category, a top 10 category. People began to view us as an Arizona State or a Texas or a USC or a Miami. So the level of exposure exploded, the quality of talent exploded, and we had that run there for 8 or 10 years, which I think we were as good or not maybe the best college baseball team in America.
Well, let me talk about a couple of your players. How did you find Pete Incavilla and your thoughts on him and you as his coach? What's your feelings when Pete Incavilla was named by the National Magazine's the College Player of the Century?
Well, I agreed with it. that was easy. I knew Pete's brother, Tony, at Arizona when I was at Yavapai. I played against him. I'd attempted to recruit him as he was a little unhappy there and looking to transfer. That family contact opened back up, and when his name came across the draft, he was a 10th-round draft of the Giants. The Giants financially weren't in great shape at the time. And I had a recruiting concept that said, find the weak member of the herd in Major League Baseball. There are people every 3 or 4 years that really are struggling financially. They have entered front office shakeups. Well, the Giants were really struggling. They were trying to be sold. So that year we attacked the Giants draft. Barry Bonds was a second rounder. Dennis Livingston was a fifth rounder. Incavelli a 10th rounder. And so the nature of our recruiting philosophy led us to him. The family contact opened it up. We had a marvelous visit. He was basically a very crude player athletically who could hit for power but didn't have much polish. And we were able to snake him out of there. And along with these kinds of players, Dennis Livingston out of North Reading, Mass., John Farrell, the Robbie Wines, over a couple of years I was in St. Louis and met his dad Bobby at the hitting cage at Busch Stadium and recruited his son. We were able to go pick really high-quality kids and work on a national level, and I think Incavelli emerged because Pete Incavelli came with a work ethic and a attitude. To the opponent, Incavelli looked like you hate to play against him. He looked like a hippo, maybe in heat, I'm not sure. but he was a warrior. But in the dugout, he had a great heart. He cared deeply about his teammates. He invested in the game and in each other. His work ethic was the most extraordinary I've ever seen. He'd spend an hour a day before each game, each practice, working on all the drills and the teaching techniques. He evolved from 23 home runs to 29 to 48 and singularly put up the greatest offensive year that we'll ever see in college baseball. And he was a kid that wasn't a great athlete. He wasn't kinesthetically aware. He didn't have great sense of what his body was doing. He had to work continually, and I think that's followed him throughout his professional career. He had not been ultra successful, but you're looking at a guy that's that everything that he as tools was pretty average, and he had to reteach his body the same thing every Friday, before every game, before every series, to make it work. Others, the game came much easier too, and so I think all of us look back on Incavelli as the guy that not only took us to the next level, that took us right to the top. He is the focal point, but he deserved that very much so, and he was a marvelous young man.
Another just outstanding player, the player of the decade of the 1980s, Robin Ventura. How did you recruit him, and what was his ability like when he joined your club?
Well, oddly enough, we've covered some of that territory. The basketball camps I ran in Prescott in the summers, I met Robin's high school basketball coach. I had previous recruiting contacts with Lompoc High School up in the Flower Valley of Northern California, and that was a league in which he had played, and I'd recruited some players from a guy named Dan Beaudry. I also had a scout out there by the name of Bill Bowman who had previously worked the area, and those three people gave me such strong recommendations. We recruited Ventura without seeing him. First time I met Robin was at Wichita, where he came in with Santa Maria and was playing in the Summer Pro Tournament in Wichita in August.
Yes, Baseball Congress?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
And met his family there. And this is in August, obviously. So he wasn't, you know, even a guy that you thought was a priority because everybody said he's a shortstop, but he can't play shortstop. So when we first see him, Robin is not a good runner. He's an average to below average thrower. He's just not a real good athlete. He was a left-handed hitter who had a tendency to swing where the ball was, and he did not have a lot of power. So when you looked at him, you say, hey, this is a good college player. We made a good decision. We were the only Division I club probably to recruit him. And all those, I was beginning to wonder about all my friends on the coast who had recommended him so highly. But he couldn't run a jump. Well, you know, he still can, but he's running the bank with about $8 million a year now. That seems to be fast enough. And what we found with Ventura, that he was in opposition. He was very low-key. He didn't like the spotlight. But physically, as a player, he had what we call kinesthetic awareness. You could put Robin's body in a position on film and show him what it was, and he could relate and replicate immediately that position. So he was the easiest player we ever had to teach or coach technique. He's turned him into, as an average college third baseman, is still the most remarkable thing I've seen. He is a five-time Gold Glove Major League Player All-Star, and this was a guy as a third baseman early on in his career you thought was a negative for your defensive ball club. And that's how far he's brought himself. And again, these are the kinds of stories that colleges can tell, because there is a reason professional baseball feels like that they're not good enough to sign out of high school and that they let them come to college. We're always lacking a tool or lacking several tools. and you have to go out and perform at the college level to overcome that. In Cavilla and Ventura, in consecutive six-year periods, established superstar type of things at Oklahoma State, and it obviously led us to many other players who wanted to be a part of that. They helped drive the tradition, and yes, when you think about the consecutive titles and regionals and Big Eights, you don't try to explain it. You just try, as a coach, you just try to make it happen.
Well, Gary, another one of the items you started at Oklahoma State, your influence was the Oklahoma State Baseball Hall of Fame, and I believe at last count there's 29 players in the Baseball Hall of Fame at Oklahoma State, but 17 of them are your players. How does that make you feel?
Well, I just think that's a result of doing what you're supposed to do. I think the university is a marvelous place. It loves baseball. Its people are Aggies. We're blue-collar. We're farm and ranch. Baseball is a sport they related to extraordinarily well. They were willing to support it. And so there was a lot of energy created, and the goodness of the private sector in its involvement in funding the program and supporting the program was extraordinary. I think our players felt like they were embraced by family when they came to Stillwater. It gave us a marvelous discipline and a marvelous organization and a sense of feeling and responsibility. So all of those things drove that as well. But when we saw the need to go to a Hall of Fame, it was to also recognize those past traditions that had been so valuable to me in selling the program, and to be able to recognize four or five guys a year. I think the criteria that we originally set up is that you needed to be an All-American, a first-round draft, or play in the major leagues. And surprisingly, when we put that together, I think our name list was in the 30s. And as we started that, obviously it's continued to grow. Recent addition, Scott Cunningham, who won his second game of the season this spring.
Yes.
The other day, and in a relief role, the players that come there, when they look down the wall of the baseballs, a rather staggering endorsement of the goodness of Oklahoma State University baseball.
Gary, also going through some records you had during your tenure at Oklahoma State, 76 of your players make all Big Eight. And that's, you have some talented clubs in the Big Eight during those years. 76 of your former players make all Big Eight. And at last count, I believe there's 126 of your former players play professional baseball. How does this, how does it feel when you turn on TV and you see Robin Ventura playing, or you see a young kid that you had now, he makes it to the major leagues, or Dave Malicki? How does it make you feel?
Well, it's rewarding. And I think the number between junior college and Oklahoma State days may run close to 30 major leaguers and a couple hundred guys signing professional contracts. But, that's a natural evolution of doing the things right. And more importantly, maybe, is the pride you sense in raising good husbands and good fathers and good people that have a great memory of those college experiences that they shared with teammates and coaches who had every fiber invested in the cause called Cowboy Baseball. But I'm just as proud as of guys like Stan Bond out of Bartlesville, who's now a banker, a wonderful young man who played in 81, or Mitch Copland off of that ball club who came to me at Yavapai that I transferred in a year later. And Mitch has a CPA firm in Claremore and a wonderful family. And Ray Etcheberrin, who's living in Phoenix, and Brad Beanblossom. So it wasn't about necessarily becoming a great pro, and it's easy to highlight Jeremy Burnett's and his $13 million over 4 years, but his teammate from Conroe, Texas, is a head junior college coach at Eastern Oklahoma, Todd Shelton. And you're every bit as proud as Todd Shelton, because within the context of what we tried to do, most of these young men found a direction, found a path, and became quality people and are making a positive contribution. They feel good about the past experience. They're representatives and ambassadors of what I call the athletic experience, whether it's at Oklahoma State or any place else. And it's what makes us so proud of the game is that, yeah, we have failures, and by golly, they're reported automatically immediately if you do have a failure. And we're going to continue to have some that fail. But the great majority of those who come out of that kind of program are turning into very good men that are leaders and contributors to a society. We need so much more of this kind of commitment and discipline in our agencies within our society and within our culture. And so I think often of Stan Bond and Ray Etchebaren and George Chadwick and people that did not have great pro careers that were good people who made great contributions and became the best they could be, that within their potentials they fulfilled those and they found within themselves this greatness, this ability, this process that you go through that teaches you how to be disciplined and how to share and how to love and how to care. This process is a process that once learned through the athletic experience is transformed into everyday situations in life, and it makes for good people. Those are the people, and that is the feeling you have of sense of pride as a coach when you have that kind of influence, or hopefully have that kind of influence on young people.
Well, one you did mention, I know you would mention him, but I will. In 1987, your son, Rocky Ward, is a catcher for you, and he makes all-academic Big 8 with a 3.3 grade point average. Were you more proud of his batting average or his grade point average?
Well, I'd be extraordinarily proud. I think, one, I really didn't want the young man to play for me. I don't think it's right for sons to play for their fathers. And I always had that feeling from the day that Jay Wilkerson left Oklahoma and went to Duke to go to school. I said, that's a good decision. And I tried to explain this to my family, and obviously the great driving tradition Oklahoma State brought both sons, Rocky and Roger, to Oklahoma State at times. They both did so without my blessing to a certain degree because I knew going in that this is very difficult for them. But what I didn't know is that when that young man walked to the plate for the first time, that my heart as a father was so involved with that that it absolutely broke any concentration I possibly had as a coach. And I found dealing with the emotions of being a father at third base were extraordinarily difficult, that you can't separate them, that the love you have for your child is so extraordinary that it transcends any of the importance of the game. And trying to be the ultimate professional, I battled this. And I think these are things that are that maybe most coaches and dads don't understand. But I think it's very selfish of us sometimes to coach our sons in situations like that. And I think realistically, they're better off. But he looked me dead in the eye and he says, I'm coming to Oklahoma State. And his mother obviously was in favor of this. And so I was outvoted. And I said, well, you may or may not play. And he said, I understand that. But I've been other places. You've sent me to Texas and here and there. I'm coming back and playing at Oklahoma State. If I'm not good enough, cut me. And I said, I may have to. So just to go through those emotions, I thought it was a difficult time. I think players treat him differently. I think fans treat him differently. I think after he went through the experience, he understands it was unique. We probably neither one would trade it for anything in the world. But if I had the third son come along, he said, Dad, I want to play for you. I'd say, no, go play someplace else. Mm-hmm. I still think that's the best deal for your team and for your family relationship. It's so fragile, and you have to handle it with such kid gloves. I think it impacts sometime your ball club. But, yeah, you're proud of him. He's now the head coach at New Mexico State. My youngest son is the head coach at Northeastern A&M here in Miami. I have a daughter that's graduating from Stillwater. People that are parents understand that's an all-consuming love that sometimes is pretty blind.
Yes. One more thing about your baseball career at Oklahoma State. You coached 19 years at Oklahoma State. And 18 of those years, you're ranked in the top 25 at the end of the season, and 9 times, you're in the top 5. That must give you a feeling that you did your job well at Stillwater in raising the national awareness of Oklahoma State in baseball. That's an amazing record, and you should be commended for that over at Oklahoma State.
But, well, I think, Wayne, so many people have asked you to explain that, and I'm not sure I can, but there was one thing that old farm rural life where we started today taught me a little bit about it, is that when you finish a crop and it's harvested, you don't sit around and put a trophy on the wall remembering that you had 37 bushels of wheat an acre. That doesn't feed you next year. And so maybe the cut-and-dried, matter-of-fact approach that I had was, when I came out of Omaha, I never was disappointed with a ball club. I felt almost every year that we had a game that was winnable, we'd win it. Sometimes we got beat, and sometimes we weren't good enough. But I don't think I ever left a season feeling like I hadn't invested enough or the ball club had failed me. Maybe one occasion. But throughout that, you immediately turn it loose. And I never kept trophies. I never kept mementos. My mind and my soul carried what had happened in the past. I forgave myself for the last year, and immediately when I hit Stillwater in June, we gave up the past. And so we didn't walk around. I think you have a choice when you have success that you can buy into the adulation, you can buy into the bandwagons. But let me tell you, the people that told me no in 79 and 80 and 81, when they came wanting to be a part of the program in 82, 82, and 83, when it was already established, I didn't need them then. And I don't know that I was cold, but the people that help you build it, that help you put the vehicle together, they're welcome to get in and drive with you. When the season's over, it's over, and you put aside accomplishments, and you don't live in the past. You immediately start at ground zero, and it is going to have to be this way because this is going to be a different ball club. Some graduate, some sign. You can remember the past and use it as great energy, but you don't. The past doesn't do anything. The saying I think we used to look at is that tradition is inherited, greatness is earned. And I kept that around my office along with hundreds of these silly oaky philosophies, but they were important to me. And I also kept one around that said, friends come and go, enemies accumulate. But to remind yourself that every year somewhere in there you failed, and there was a player that you didn't reach, and there were somebody you didn't communicate, that you're still in a growth experience yourself, that you're good and you're getting better. Do not swell up with pride over what you've accomplished. Choose to grow and choose to forgive yourself of the past, whether it's been beautiful or whatever the case, and immediately rebuild. And I think young people need this. They need a fresh, new approach that the guy says, I'm not satisfied, we're going to start again. And we did this every year for 19 years at Oklahoma State, or every year at Yavapai for 8 years, and we continue to try to do this as long as we're involved with coaching. And if there's any secret to our philosophy, I think that has something to do with how we were able to rebuild it and sustain it over a long period of time.
Gary, when did your back injury become too painful for you, and when did you decide to retire?
Well, I heard it in college in New Mexico State playing Arizona State. I got undercut, and we now call those they're just structural fractures. But and I struggle with it off and on, riding buses and doing the work and all those kind of things. But I heard it as far as the rupture of the back in at Kansas in 93, and I lived with that for a couple of years, and I had different times with TENS units and medication, anti-inflammatories and chiropractors, and so it was ongoing. But the rupture created a problem where, in order to sustain myself through the season, it had just become unbearable, and so we chose to undergo surgery. And we had a couple of other minor details that reported ending up with three different surgeries through a period of time. And in order to continue at Oklahoma State, we were having to stay on muscle relaxers and anti-inflammatories. Even though we're on a good rehab program, even though everybody at Oklahoma State was trying to make it work, I was traveling separate from the ball club, going in a day early so I could rest, you know, not coaching a doubleheader for 5 or 6 hours and getting on a bus for 8 hours, which we'd done for a long time. I just couldn't do it. And the surgeon was saying, if you don't get this together and you don't get this rehabbed, you know, the next one's going to be a multi-fusion and your wife's going to tie your shoes for you the rest of your life. We did not want to give it up. We fought it as hard as we could fight it for a long, long time. There was nobody there that wasn't willing to do whatever I wanted to do. But I felt like, well, what we've talked about today, I could not sustain that by beginning to delegate out my entire job to a lot of other people and to sit around as a titled figurehead. I believe it's important if you lose a game at Iowa State that you're on the bus with the kids eating a Burger King and that you commiserate with them and you understand their behavior and you share their pain and you prepare for the next game. If I'm going to the motel and laying down and flying back commercial the next day, I don't think that's right. And I couldn't come to terms with that after a year, even though in 96 we go to a College World Series. I felt like I was beginning to cheat the program. And above all else, I owed it to all those people that I had sold on the passion and the dream, the fact that every waking moment of Gary Ward's days at Oklahoma State as your representative, our effort is to do something that enhances our opportunity to win a national title. And so that philosophy that had driven me for so long, all of a sudden, I could not capably reinforce that with my people. And I felt like I had begun to cheat the system. Yeah, I could have stayed there for 5 or 6 years, turned over the duties, had a quality program, probably won some games. But our game, our goal, was not to win the Big 8 title or to win the regional. Our goal was to get to College World Series and have a chance to win a national title. And we could not get that accomplished. And I, with the reduction of energy and the reduction of capability, I didn't see me being able to take them there. I thought it was for new leadership. So we gave it up.
This is my favorite question to ask you, and I love your ideas on this, and this is my final question. You've been real patient. Gary, if you were the commissioner of college baseball, what would you do to change the sport? I've heard you speak on this many times, moving the season back and this type of thing. What would you do if you were the commissioner of college baseball and had supreme authority?
Well, it's a complicated issue, but in simplistic terms, I would take the game to April to August. I would parallel it with minor league and pro baseball, and I would go to war with professional baseball over draft and rights. And college baseball could easily become a nationally telecast sport. It could become a national revenue producer, and it becomes the third major sport in the U.S. The problems are huge because the Southern people have ideal situations, and the guy at Texas or USC or Miami doesn't want to vote for a level playing ground. But we can play not 56 in lousy weather, pulling tarps back and forth, freezing our buns off in Missouri in April, and go to a normal season, and pro baseball's in trouble because we have an exciting product. When you can get 10,000, 12,000 to college baseball game in April, sometimes in lousy weather, when you can sell a couple $100,000 in season tickets and in a college baseball season held to 56 games, give me a 90 to 100 game schedule. I'll just play Tuesday night. I'll play Friday, Saturday, Sunday, five-day weeks. Kids can go to school year-round, which we ought to be doing anyway. Why are millions and billions of dollars of school facilities lying idle in the summertime? Because of a tradition. And education and baseball are the two most traditional of things, and we're 25 years behind the time. We've been caught by gender equity. It's burying us because we need money and participation opportunities for women. The only thing that separates you out is revenue production. And while we had the opportunity, I worked at this for years in the late 80s, and it fell on deaf ears because everybody, like the farmer, and me being a farmer, I can say this, everybody in college baseball in those years, we had television. It was all over the place. The sport was booming. The College World Series was raising a hair on the back of people's neck. We had a chance to be a visionary and move forward, and they chose to protect their little 40 acres at Athens, Georgia. The leadership of our area will always be in the South because that's where championships have been won. Those coaches chose either not to work, and a lot of them said, you know, I don't want that kind of pressure. I'm afraid I'm going to get fired. Well, get out. Go do something else. But don't stay in the competitive business of college athletics. Choke your sport to death. So I think to a certain degree, pro baseball has interacted with us because we're not providing them a feeder system. If we were organized, if we were together, if we were unselfish, if we were thinking about the future of the game, 10 years ago, we would have made these transitions, and you would have seen great baseball facilities, and you would see a five-game series with Oklahoma and Oklahoma State in the middle of July, and you can't build a stadium big enough in Oklahoma to fill it. And I just rue that. I think we missed a golden opportunity. Now the game has changed a little bit. Pro ball has done a better job. The climate's not the same. Gender equity has the money's changed and altered to the point where programs like Tulsa and SMU and Colorado State may never come back to college baseball. And there's not any reason for them to do it if you're going to ask Colorado to play in March. But Minnesota and Michigan and Ohio State don't even have the same chance, period, of competing that Oklahoma State and Oklahoma and Wichita. And even further, Florida State and Florida and Miami and Arizona State and Southern California, they have ideal situations. So we have a college sport we love. It's poorly placed, poorly marketed. It's being choked to death by lack of vision and lack of leadership, not only in our own business, by educators themselves.
Preach on, brother.
Yes, amen, brother.
I like that. You are correct. All right. Gary, thank you very much. I sure appreciate it. What's your title now with NEO?
I have my first great title. I'm now called Director of Baseball. First time I've ever been a director. You know, it's pretty heady stuff.
And you raise fundraising and...
I still have a day-to-day contact with the players. I still go on the field and do some stuff. I coach my coaches. Ryan Graves and Corey Burton off the 96 Oklahoma State Club are here as assistants to my son Roger as the head coach. My job is to take some administrative load off of them. We've raised $25,000. We have tons of money to have to raise in order to get our facility upgraded to bring the program up to regional competitive and national competitive levels. It's been a chore, and it's very difficult, but it's been a joy at the same time, not only being around my family more, but getting out and doing some of the same things we did to build, and to build at the bottom up as we did at Yavapai or Oklahoma State. And I don't know whether we're going to be successful here. That's the challenge. But I like the place. It's a wonderful junior college. It's a good community. If we stay with it and work at it, I think you'll see Northeastern A&M be very successful in college baseball.
Good. All right. Thank you so much.
You bet, Wayne.
Okay.